It's the Transatlantic Conservative Edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, posthumous weddings, pink slime, and the conclusion portion of our interview with Tony Sobrato on conservatism here and in Europe. Now let's begin episode 159.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are aware of the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your skeptical philosopher, political scientist. Ethan, I understand there's been a whooping big controversy here in the Lower Mainland.
You couldn't have picked a better intro for that segment, because we have actually in Vancouver, for probably what is the first time in a long time, a whooping cough outbreak. Now, we've actually sort of talked about this in the past a little bit, with sort of cases of whooping cough in the BC area. According to some estimations, there have now been 200 infections in the Fraser Valley and the Vancouver area, as well as potentially up to 38 cases in the Vancouver area, stretching from all over Metro Vancouver, Richmond, Vancouver, Burnaby, and elsewhere. Whooping cough, also known as pertussis, is a bacterial infection. It is very contagious. So if you have noticed that you have a sort of month-long recurring cough, it might be whooping cough. Now, the disease is not usually fatal in adults, but it can be very dangerous for young children. Because of the outbreak, Vancouver health authorities are now offering a free vaccine for people who are either concerned about the welfare of their children or who may actually have the infection themselves. So the people who are eligible for the vaccination are pregnant women, their partners, and those who regularly come into contact with children or have children under the age of 18 months. Now, the vaccine, like I said, can help prevent whooping cough. And it is not usually fatal, of course, in adults, but nevertheless, we should encourage everyone to get it because, again, this can be fatal in young people. And if we don't create enough herd immunity, the virus will be able to spread amongst the population a lot easier.
What is herd immunity? Are you saying people are cows?
Somewhat, yes. But more importantly, what it means is that by having a large enough population that has been vaccinated, we can prevent the virus from having sort of the ability to mutate and move around our population. That way, there are a few people out there who probably can't get the vaccine for various reasons. They will be protected by the rest of us who are all immunized against the outbreak. Now, for people who are curious about where they can get the vaccination, it's available through family doctors, public health clinics, and some pharmacies. You should call HealthLink BC at 811 to get more information on where you can get the vaccination. Remember, it's free. And even if you've already had the vaccination, they do tend to wear off after about 5 years. If you already have whooping cough and you're an adult, you're probably not going to be in any danger. But by getting the vaccination, you can render yourself non-contagious within about 5 days. So even if you have a recurring cough, do consider getting the vaccination. It would definitely help out the people around you.
That sounds like very, very good advice to give, Ethan. So is this part of some nefarious plot that this outbreak has happened, or is this sort of a fluke incident?
Well, I mean, I think that a large portion of this is due to vaccination rates dropping so low. One of the problems is that there are several communities in the interior, the Fraser Valley and such, where vaccinations are not being kept up. And so you have these populations of people where old diseases like whooping cough are allowed to sort of spread. And because it's a well-traveled area, it's getting spread back into Vancouver and heavily trafficked areas. So the disease spreads around because there's just simply not enough people who are vaccinated to help prevent that spread. And whether they're not vaccinating for religious reasons or whether they're not vaccinating for other silly reasons, like they think it's going to cause autism or something, either way, it's creating a public health risk. So hopefully what we can do with this is raise enough awareness without somebody dying, hopefully, that these vaccinations do save lives and they are really important. And then, and also they will cost our healthcare system. I mean, providing enough free vaccinations to prevent this disease outbreak is going to cost the public taxpayer a lot of money. And this could have been avoided if we had all kept up with our regular immunization schedule and not allowed this disease to spread around.
Not to mention the healthcare costs of those children that may get infected and require extra sort of healthcare for that. It also shows that, you know, Vancouver is an international port in many ways. And in some ways, we need to be a bit more vigilant, I think, than your average place, because sometimes the source of this infection may actually originate offshore. Then it finds some place where it can sort of incubate, which you kind of mentioned, the hinterland of BC, and then comes back and hits with a vengeance when it hits the rest of it. It also is great to exemplify the fact that everyone says, well, you know, it's my own kid and I should have a right to do what I want with my child. Where do you get off telling me how I should live my life and how I should treat my children? Well, this is a very good case of where it does matter, because what you do for your child not only affects you, but it affects all of us, and it can have large ramifications in society in general.
Yeah. And people might say, well, you know, 38 cases in Vancouver is not a large number, but in actuality, last year in the first 3 months, there were no cases at all. And all last year, there were only 9 cases total. So clearly, this is an outbreak. Clearly, it's a public risk. And that's why we need to take these extra precautions and get the vaccine out there.
Yes. Yes, we do. Now, speaking of taking precautions, we're going to shift. There are many things you can learn from mass murder. Last week, France was rocketed by a multi-murderer executed by one of its citizens. Now, there are a lot of important facts that arose from this. One of them wasn't that France was not the nation of origin of the shooter. Apparently, he was of Algerian extraction. I'm not quite sure what that means. Maybe they have some large needle that they take people out of Algeria and inject them into France. But he was born in France. It wasn't the failure of the French security service, the DCRI, nor even the rapidity of French politicians to ratchet up the xenophobia in this an election year for them in France. No, none of that seems nearly as interesting as the fact that France, a country that does not allow same-sex marriage, nonetheless does allow you to marry the dead. Yes, apparently since the 1950s, it has been legal for one person to marry a dead person, a posthumous wedding. Now, this is limited to France, as far as my research could find out. It has its origins in what they called proxy marriages during World War I, where, you know, people in the front wanted to marry their sweetheart back home, or usually the soldiers come back for a bit of leave, have a bit of scrumpet, get someone knocked up, go back to the front, and they have to do these proxy weddings. And it was discovered that in more than one case, the proxy on the war front side was actually dead when the marriage occurred. So it was sort of a de facto posthumous wedding. It seems, though, that one of the soldiers killed during this French murder spree was engaged to a very pregnant girlfriend. But Friday, President Sarkozy authorized the wedding to go forward. It should be noted that she will not necessarily gain financially from this. The largest benefit seems to ensure that the child is not classified as illegitimate. And as well, at least, again, originally as it was conceived, the merger of two families, which is sort of, you know, the contractual aspect of weddings. Although I do suspect in this particular case, she will gain widow's benefits because of the nature of this particular case. Now, to preface what's about to follow, I in no way intend to demean, undermine, or denigrate this woman or her soon-to-be husband, late husband. I wish her the best in the situation life has dealt her, and may she find happiness in spite of the personal tragedy that happened. Now, I wonder if the slippery slope argument works the other way. People in the States and here in Canada have often contended that if you allowed same-sex marriage, that if you altered or spoiled, quote, the sanctity of marriage, then all bets are off, that men will be marrying dogs and women will be having marriages with trees or something. What are your thoughts? This has struck me, one, as bizarre, but two, this almost goes to show you that you know, one, same-sex marriage does nothing to sanctity of marriage, and two, that there's more to marriage than just marriage. Ethan?
Well, it's kind of interesting that Sarkozy authorized the wedding to go forward. Does that imply that it wouldn't have gone forward without his authorization?
It does. In fact, this is a special dispensation. I think where the technicality comes into it is that sort of on the marriage certificate, a court official has to sign in place of the husband. That's why it has to be authorized by the president.
Well, I mean, it is sort of a bizarre situation. I mean, but not altogether surprising based on sort of what we know about the sort of social history of France. I mean, this was a country, after all, that gave medals to women who had more than like 10 babies. So I'm not surprised that they would go out of their way to allow women to marry soldiers who have died in combat or died in a different way. I mean, it's unfortunate that there's still this kind of notion that if a child is born from a woman who isn't married, that the child is somehow illegitimate or, you know, not a proper citizen, which I think is just atrocious for one thing. But then the argument about this whole slippery slope thing, I mean, I don't know. Like, I think it's kind of it shouldn't be. And if it really honestly is, then, you know, it's a sad day for society, in my opinion, that we could point at this and be like, see, people will marry goats now. I don't know. Kind of makes me depressed as a human being.
Yes. And I laugh at your depression, Ethan. Does that just make it all the way out? No, I agree. I agree with you. I mean, I don't really think I have a big issue with this posthumous wedding thing. I find it ironic that they allow, like I say, dead people to marry, but they don't allow live people to marry because of their gender. And I mean, they may make the case about, well, what about procreation? Well, in an odd sort of way, that job had already been done before they got married. So that doesn't seem like a valid case in this case. And it's bizarre. Of course, I wonder if that's going to come to Canada. Maybe that'll be something the new leader of the NDP will promote here in Canada, along with same-sex marriage, posthumous marriage, just to keep that going.
Well, maybe if the British do it, then you know how close we are with the British, of course. Maybe the Queen could declare it. That would probably have some oomph behind it in Canada, I bet.
Yes, yes. And that's a topic for another day.
Indeed.
We're going to go for a commercial break, and when we come back, we're going to deal with the slimy issue of meat.
Hello, this is Tony Sobrado, social scientist and theorist on conspiracy theories. You are listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR Radio 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia. You can also listen to the show by subscribing to iTunes, and I hope you enjoy your skeptical discussions and debate.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker here on CITR, of course. So we're talking a bit about the pink slime, otherwise known as beef. Is that right, Don?
Yes, Ethan. According to my research, the term pink slime is a relatively new one that seems to have come on the scene about a couple of months ago, although the product it refers to has been sold for decades. As a nutritional or food issue, this really only came to prominence when Jamie Oliver did a bit about it a year ago, as well as some recent news articles. Technically, pink slime is mechanically separated meat. As I said, it's a practice that has been used since about the 80s. Originally, the beef product, and it is 100% beef, was used as animal feed, i.e. dog food. That was not because it was unfit for human consumption, but because restaurants and the food industry thought it linguistically unappetizing. I mean, mechanically separated meat or pink slime is just not something you want to put on the McDonald's menu. People aren't likely to buy it. In the old days, a term we're using a lot lately. Maybe there's a show on that. Anyway, in the old days, once you have butchered the cow, i.e. liberated all the steaks and roasts, the rest was thrown into the garbage. There was no way to extract any more meat. Then, in the 80s, someone came up with a process to do just this. This meat is produced by taking unbutcherable parts, i.e. bones, ligaments, and the other parts left over, which still have meat attached to it. It's placed into a centrifuge, where they are mechanically separated from the non-meat parts, bone, etc. The meat is sent along a straw-like tube where it's exposed to ammonia gas.
This raises the pH level of the meat, killing all the pathogens like E. coli and etc. Now, as I said, the original buyers were pet food makers, but corporations looking to make an extra buck by spending less overcame their previous linguistic difficulties of selling this product and started calling it filler. So your typical McDonald's burger would have about 20 to 25% of this filler meat. So they still get to say 100% pure beef while dropping the pure ground chuck. Ironically, it's actually better than regular hamburger in the sense that it's 90% lean, whereas your chuck is usually about 80% lean. Now, from what you hear in the press and online, you get the impression this is some kind of toxic poison, that it is unsafe because it harbors pathogens, that the industry is feeding you a chemical goo.
Well, it is chemical goo, of course. I mean, that's obvious, isn't it? It better be chemical goo.
Yes, it is chemical goo in the sense that all things are chemicals, and it's goo in that it's ground up meat like sausage. But they're not meaning it in the sort of scientifically benign way, but as some kind of warning, beware. To give an example, I watched the Jamie Oliver bit. In it, he had a butcher do his best on a cow shank. Parts left over, Jamie put into a clothes dryer to simulate the centrifuge. He then took some ground beef, not from the dryer, and folks at home, do not use your dryer as a meat centrifuge. Besides being ineffective and unhealthy, it will likely void your warranty. So he has this simulated, separated meat. He then makes a big thing about going to the cleaning supply closet and pouring a couple of jugs of ammonia cleaner into it. Now, this is not accurately depicting what happens. It's kind of like adding chunks of frozen CO2 to water to demonstrate the idea of carbonation, or insert your own perhaps better analogy here. In fact, the use of ammonia gas counters the claim it's dangerous because of pathogens. The gas essentially sterilizes the meat, making it actually safer than your regular ground chuck. From my research, there would be no cases where the recall of a meat product has been traced back to contamination originating from this filler meat. Okay, so it's unappetizing but safe. So I was having a conversation with one of our valued listeners when things kind of went weird. Well, weird from my perspective. They got really, really upset that I was defending this culinary atrocity. Whenever I brought up a fact about the product, especially its safety, it was met with dismissive hostility. So I began to think about why consumers were freaking out over this, what appeared to be, to me at least, a benign issue, a non-issue. I came up with some things that I think are at the root of this hostility. One thing that arose is that we currently have a disconnect between what we eat and where it comes from. You go back 100 years, and most people saw their food au naturel before they ate it. Well, by that I mean most everyone had saw a cow or been on a farm. Farmers were a much more important part of society, so you knew a lot more about what went on with how and where and who got your food. People had substantial gardens. You grew a lot of your own food. You may not have understood the biology, but you put a seed in the ground, corn came up. You picked your corn, you cooked it, you ate it. It was a clear path, and you were involved in most of it, or at least you knew what was going on. You knew the person who butchered your meat. Now, what real food we have is shipped halfway around the world, cut by automatons we'll never see, let alone know. Most of our food now is actually processed food, bearing little resemblance to real food in both form and composition. Have you looked at the ingredient list on a can of corn? Take a look at the ingredients on pizza. Betcha one quarter of them you actually know what that is. So there is a disconnect, a sense of powerlessness. We don't really know where our food comes from. We don't even know really what it is. And we don't seem to have a lot of choice in it. Everything is like that. It all seems to come in a black box. I go to the grocery store. I buy something that is called food. And I have no idea what or where it comes from. It's easy to distrust this sort of black box food. This then feeds into our hatred of corporations. I mean, I'm the first one to jump on the anti-corp bandwagon. Corporations are responsible now for producing all of our food. We don't have the neighborhood butcher. At least most of us don't have the neighborhood butcher. We go to the grocery store. Grocery stores are corporations. We buy our food from corporations. It's all corporate. We don't like corporations. It's one of the growing memes in our society. So we get this confluence of having black box food, food we don't know really what it is or where it comes from, coming from corporations who we don't really trust. If we can't trust corporations in making our food, then how can I trust my food?
Well, yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I don't think you don't even have to go back 100 years, even say 50 or 60 years. You definitely knew where most of the food you were eating came from. I mean, a lot of times it was either bought locally in whatever sort of community that you lived in, Maybe it was different if you lived in a big city, but if you lived in a small town, you know, like my parents probably did, they knew the butcher who made their meat. They knew the farmers who grew their food. They knew where they got their fruit and vegetables. And there was this kind of a small town vibe about the whole thing. And then, you know, along comes McDonald's and all these big corporations that, and on one level, it's kind of like, well, they're so big and they can't be accountable and you don't know what they're doing. But at the same time, they also want to make money, and it's not really in their best interest to disgust their customers or poison them or feed them stuff that's, you know, I don't know, like made of people or something. So at a certain level, corporations, by the fact that they want to be a good, you know, make a good profit, honestly, I think that you have to trust them at some point, because otherwise they're just really crappy at doing what they do.
And that goes into the next thing is there's another sense of distrust or a lack of faith of government to protect its citizens. Again, with the political climate to sort of smash everything government and we need to privatize everything, and the willingness, you know, either through budget cuts or through pro-business policies to gut any regulatory commissions, we no longer think the government is going to be there to protect our food supply and all that. And we seem powerless in the face of this corporocracy that we've created. The fact that, you know, we look at it and there's all this money that's being spent to buy our politicians, buy our elections. I mean, I have said it myself, and there are ramifications for this that come out in the weirdest places. And I think this is one of those weird areas where you get this sort of pink slime, it must be poison, because of all these other aspects.
Or, you know, somebody might have seen like Ghostbusters 2 or something.
In the face of all this powerlessness, there's a deeper issue that we as skeptics must be vigilant about. We need to police our own, if you will. In a world where, at least in the media and probably the population at large, there is a lack of understanding of science, and we need to make sure that when we fight these battles, we fight the right battles. Because think about it. When you couple this lack of understanding with the active attempts by interest groups who claim, intentionally in most cases, that we cannot trust science. I mean, those people who are denialists of climate change, promoters of intelligent design, the anti-vax movement, I think this is sort of a blowback on that. I mean, if people told you you can't trust scientists about the weather, if you can't trust them about your health, people will say, why the hell should I trust them about food? Ethan?
You know, I think that part of the problem is, like you said, people don't trust the authorities in our society because there have been times when they've let us down. The problem is that they also don't seem to trust science. Of course, I think trust is the wrong word. People shouldn't trust science so much as they should try to understand science. And I think if they could understand how science works and how we come to a scientific consensus, they might be more willing to be skeptical when an interest group comes along and says something that is not scientifically supported, whether that's anti-evolution sentiment or anti-vaccination sentiment. If they have a background in science, not even a background, but just a basic understanding of the logical process that we understand and evaluate claims. I guess we're asking people to be skeptical, which is not surprising, but if they are skeptical, they would be able to respond better to these, you know, rather strange attempts to confuse and mislead, and in most cases, I think, cause a rabble. And when it comes to things like food, which obviously we all need food, we're all hyper aware that, you know, food can be mishandled and that could have really real consequences. So we have to be extra skeptical of how food is made and how it's, you know, brought to the dinner table. And then as being good skeptics, we have to be aware that there are interest groups and that there are other narratives out there who want to convince us that food is bad. I mean, look at all the pseudosciences that arise from food, whether it's sort of the raw food people who believe that you should just eat food raw without cooking it, or it's the people who believe that factory farming is terrible or that free-range farming is terrible, beneficial, whatever. There are all these notions out there that how you make your food is really going to have a huge impact on you. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. And we need to be skeptical about these claims so that we don't get suckered into something and, you know, ultimately waste money or jeopardize food that we could be eating and enjoying.
Yes, Ethan. Again, I hate being the one to defend big meat. Well, actually, I'm not. I'm actually defending science, and that's always palatable. You know, this topic might leave you with a desire for an extra heaping of skepticism while you're in luck. After this break, we will have our final portion of our interview with Tony Sobrato. This week, we'll discuss conservatism on both sides of the pond.
How do you start to get close to animals that lived hundreds of millions of years ago? Dinosaurs
were just giant lizards. But a truly unique kind of reptile.
Dinosaurs roamed for more than 150 million years. Dinosaurs roamed in amazing shapes and sizes. Very few left evidence of their existence. And those bones never ceased to fascinate us.
The more we find, the more complete our understanding. Utterly awe-inspiring, the world of the dinosaurs.
There are always new discoveries out there, waiting to be found.
The more we find, the more complete our understanding. Utterly awe-inspiring, the world of the dinosaurs.
Tyrannosaurus, the largest species the world has ever seen. The dinosaurs, all the dinosaurs, followed a well-trod trail to oblivion.
Rock layers span the age of dinosaurs. The deeper the layer, the older the rock. At the top, rock from the Cretaceous. Below that, the Jurassic. And near the bottom, Red Triassic Badlands. When dinosaurs first appeared.
The more we find, the more complete our understanding. Utterly awe-inspiring, the world of the dinosaurs.
Million years ago,
the meteorite smashed into the earth.
Toward our planet, at 100,000 kilometers a second.
If we'd never found their bones, we wouldn't ever have known. These ancient animals ever existed. If we'd never found their bones, we wouldn't ever have known. These ancient animals ever existed. If we find, the more complete our understanding. Utterly awe-inspiring, the world of the dinosaurs.
There are always new discoveries out there, waiting to be found.
The more we find, the more complete our understanding. Utterly awe-inspiring, the world of the dinosaurs.
There are always new discoveries out there, waiting to be found.
Utterly awe-inspiring, the world of the dinosaurs.
Welcome back, and we have once again Tony Sobrato back in our virtual studio. For those who missed it,
Tony is a research analyst and social scientist currently based in London, author of the soon-to-be-published book, Who Rules the World? An Analysis of Conspiracy Theory. He also contributes to the Huffington Post. Hello, Tony. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Don. It's a pleasure to be here. Hello, everyone listening in Vancouver and Canada.
You've written about conservatism. Canada seems to be about a 10-year delay from the U.S. Whatever happens in the U.S. happens here in Canada. So in this sense, it's kind of important to us. Presently in the United States, as witnessed by the GOP nomination campaign, there seems to be an occurring and sort of mutation of classic conservatism into something that is, quote, sort of new, twisted form of it. From my studies in political science, the most basic thing about conservatism is sort of a resistance to change. That is, what we have is good, and change, or at least rapid change, is dangerous and possibly catastrophic. The current crop of GOP candidates claim to be conservative, but they advocate rapid and major changes to the social political landscape of the country. They do this, of course, by making appeals to the distant past, be it the Founding Fathers or the Bible, But these are not, at least in most cases, even seem to be valid appeals. By valid, I mean, for example, they claim the U.S. was a Christian nation where the church had a major role in politics, and they view this was supported and intended by the founding fathers. That is not historically accurate. One could say the U.S. was a Christian nation in the sense the majority of its population were Christian, but the separation of church and state was fundamental to the success of the early U.S. I think without that firewall, the early American experiment probably would have failed due to sectarian fighting. So this is just using the U.S. as an example. In England, they have their own sort of struggles with conservative old and new. However, it seems to me, quite a different type of conservatism in England and Europe than in the U.S. Your view of conservatism is slightly different than mine, I think. How do you see conservatism as being manifest in the current political circus, both in the U.S. and the U.K.?
Yes, a very interesting point. I think the conservative kind of dichotomy right now and the approach being kind of manifest in the United States is its very own kind of entrenched reactionary conservatism. And it's different from what we're seeing in England and Europe. Now, there's obviously different interpretations and different standpoints behind conservatism, but if we'll take, say, two of its central features in the paradigm, which is A, it's kind of the conservation of values. So obviously the general philosophical mantra here is if it isn't broken, don't fix it. So we don't want massive revolutions. If everything's functioning just fine, we'll keep it as it is, and we have a conservation of values. At the same time, conservatism, the actual political philosophy, say, espoused by this founder, Edmund Burke, is that it has to be flexible and pragmatic in the face of changing social phenomena. And that is kind of outlined conservatism in this country, in the UK, since the Second World War. So the Conservative Party right now, under David Cameron, is obviously kind of adaptable, and it's making itself malleable in terms of global and social needs. So we obviously see that we have no issues with homosexuality in this country. I mean, socially there still could be issues, but in terms of the actual political and state line, is that there is no problem with homosexuality. We have open homosexuals in the government Conservative Party, and we also have the Conservative Party and the Liberal Party, and basically all three parties in Britain are for green policies. And no one in this country is espousing global warming as a conspiracy theory. So in the UK and in Europe, at least, we have traditional conservatism in the sense that it isn't looking for radical piecemeal kind of change and a revolution. It's kind of advocating more a keeping the establishment going as far as it needs to go. But when it needs to change, it's changing. And we're seeing this with policies. What you've got in America is currently under the Republican Party, and obviously certain branches of it, say the Tea Party, which is extremely dogmatic and conservative, is you're seeing a kind of remoulding and a readaptation of what it is to be a conservative traditionalist, because, first of all, they're not actually being adaptable to social change. They're just basically still espousing dogmatic canon. And we see this in terms of its attitude towards not just a single-sex marriage, but also the actual legitimacy of being a homosexual, which is kind of a strange contradiction in terms of when you compare it to the British or the European conservative movement, which is still conservative in certain values, but is still adapting to social needs. The Republican Party in America isn't doing this. They're still basically advocating just the pure conservation of social values and ideals, where these kind of relationships between people are basically just wrong, inherently wrong. And their recourse to this is based largely on Christian values. So they're being unconservative in a traditional point in two ways. First of all, by not adapting to social change, which certain strands of conservatism say is necessary, and B, justifying this reactionary attitude and its decline and refusal to change by adhering to usually biblical testaments in terms of homosexuality is wrong. And we also see this kind of reactionary issue kind of spilled over into other policies, where we have a certain aspects in the Republican Party that don't want to sign up to green treaties, and they still want to advocate kind of proliferation and the advocation of big business, and basically the environment takes a second stand, if you want to say. It's on the back burner. It's not a real issue. And this is a very interesting phenomenon, and like you were saying, it's quite odd at the moment in American certain respects. And I personally think that this kind of reactionary conservatism has kind of come about only the post-Bush era. And that's for the main reason that when Bush, after 9/11, the invasion of Iraq, he was basically, his party and the people behind him basically in kind of in a bad state in terms of everyone had lost faith in them and he was unelectable. So what he did, which is actually kind of a clever PR strategy move behind the consultants behind the Republican Party at the time, which was, well, if they're going to get votes and they need to get another election, we're really going to have to play to the grassroots. We're going to have to play to the core supporters. And this is where, I mean, at the same time, it's not like George Bush is kind of being deceiving, because he is kind of, there is no lie behind it. He's not making a pretense. He is quite a Christian man, and he basically believes that same-sex marriage is wrong. So they kind of play to this, to the strengths of the party, and basically appeal to the core support, which is obviously policies on abortion and same-sex marriage. And this is, this still lingers today. And the reason it lingers today is because one aspect of what the Bush and the Republican Party did in terms of playing to the grassroots again, which is really ultra-conservative. And now, where in terms of political strategy, they have to play an opposite game to the Obama and Democratic Party. And if it wasn't for Obama's policies and the party being so in a polar opposite, then they wouldn't have to play this game with a mirror image. It's only because Obama has certain policies, for example, welfare expenditure and free medical coverage, that is so radical for the American society, because it's the more or less the first time in history that this bill has been passed, that it's so radical in one respect that the Republicans on the other side of the spectrum have to be as equally radical as him. So there's basically distancing yourself as much as you can from the current administration, going in the opposite direction, because at the end of the day, they want to present themselves as an alternative to the government. So where we've got Obama being perceived as this radical liberal slash socialist and these kind of progressive democratic views, on the other side of the spectrum, we're getting this really reactionary, conservative and dogmatic espousal, which is still treating certain issues as if they're inherently wrong, based on the Bible. And this kind of dogmatic conservatism has only come about since the post-Bush era, because if you think about the old conservative paradigm, say the Republicans in the 80s under Reagan, this was more based on the intellectual merits of Reaganomics and free market economics, mainly the Milton Friedman School, Chicago free market economics. So that was more of an intellectual game in terms of justifying the market and how it's useful for society in terms of growth, wealth and expenditure. And today, we've kind of lost that intellectual academic game to the Republican Party, and they're just basically playing the old conservative card in terms of using the Bible for justification and being as reactionary as they can. And that's one area that really sets it apart from the conservatism in Europe and Britain at the moment.
One of the things I find interesting, actually, on this particular area is, in an odd sort of way, Obama is more to the left than most of the Republicans, but I mean, he's far from what we would consider to be, you know, a socialist. But in the sort of Tea Party's GOP mantra, I mean, they're equating him to Stalin and Hitler. I mean, they're sort of creating this big, huge, radical person who doesn't really exist, and then they have to be the exact opposite to resist them. I mean, there's an interesting feedback loop there.
Oh, yeah, I completely agree with that itself. I mean, by European standards, Obama is not a socialist or a Stalinist. I mean, when the bill got passed for Medicare coverage for the most, basically for people that can't afford medical insurance in the States, they were basically, one of the first program that they went to basically discredit was the British NHS service, which, okay, isn't the most efficient kind of service in the world, but at least it guarantees you free medical care at the point of delivery. And when this was going on in America, it kind of just got transposed to the idea of he's a Stalin, he's a socialist, and it's the doctors of death, because it's kind of interesting what they did with this paradigm, as where in this country we see that basically medical coverage for everyone is free, because obviously if you had to pay for it, then there's obviously going to be different inequalities and stratas. What people in the Republican Party were doing in quite an astute way was kind of twisting the argument, was saying, well, if the government can choose what policies and what medicine and what programs are being inducted in hospitals, then they also choose who gets to live or die, which isn't necessarily the case. But the logic behind that argument was quite interesting in terms of that was kind of a well-made-up kind of schema to employ. But that whole thing with Obama is quite interesting. As you're saying, and as I agree with you, is that they've basically invented this straw man, making him a Stalinist, and look how radical he is. And at the same time, they're like, oh, we don't want that end of the spectrum, because basically he's going to curtail all your social freedoms. He's going to basically take all your tax and he's going to use it to spend it on what he wants. And he's even going to dictate to you what you're going to do for your health policy. We don't want that. We're going to be the opposite of that in the spectrum. We're going to be as conservative and reactionary as we can. And I mean, you see it all the time with certain aspects of the Republican Party. So first of all, the party has no open atheists, is it? Which I find quite interesting. And then last time around in the election, when it was Obama versus McCain, during those Republican candidacy debates, I believe it was 3 out of 8 on one of the Republican parties didn't believe in evolutionary theory. And no one can say whether they actually do believe in it or not, but this is kind of the song, this is how they preach to the choir, this is how they appeal to the base. So it's kind of to the extent that if you're not basically in a Republican camp, you're either a socialist, you're a radical, and you don't believe in Bible and a God, and this even equates to evolutionary scientists. And it's basically them just using the Bible to play to those kind of grassroots that believe that same-sex marriage is wrong, that Medicare insurance is wrong, that we need our liberties back. And even to the extent that we come from primates isn't a plausible theory, just read the Bible is basically their message. So in that respect, it's a very interesting time at the moment in American politics because of the polarization.
I even find it bizarre, but on a side note, is Mitt Romney, when he was campaigning against McCain, was seen as sort of the real conservative right-wing kind of guy. And now in this particular round of nominations, he's like the lefty guy, and he's desperately trying to claw back to the right. It's bizarre, the polarization.
It's very bizarre. I mean, and in terms of the practice of modern-day politics, I mean, the majority of modern-day politics is basically just PR work, obviously, and kind of strategy development and consultancies in terms of how you're going to play play to the people. And you see this with all politicians. They obviously have to kind of capture the middle ground. So if you look at someone in the UK like David Cameron, like when he first rose to prominence, the accusation of behind him was that he was just basically another elite person, educated at Eton, and then he's from a privileged background and he's very posh etc. And now that's all being downplayed, and he's basically a kind of an adaptable person. He's behind green policies. He's behind forms of social distribution. He's not in it to maintain the wealthy in society. So it's all the way. It's basically the way the campaigns want to portray the message. And with the Mitt Romney one, that's a perfect example. So before he was like the ultra right Mormon, and now because he's advocating forms of free medical care, those in the Republican Party are like, oh, in the end, he's a socialist just like the other guys. So it's very hard to see where you stand at any point in time in the politics game, especially in America. And it's really just a majority of it is their management team and what kind of message they're trying to put across. And it's pretty hard to be a politician in any kind of stand, especially when you're running for re-election. So it's interesting times.
Well, our time is running low. Thank you for your time and your illumination. Are there any final words you'd like to impart to our listeners?
Well, if people have found what the topics we've covered today in terms of conspiracy theories, philosophy, and social science interesting, is probably worth checking out www.tonysobrado.com, and I'll be having an interview with Dr. David Cody on philosophy and conspiracy theories and rationality and what it means to be rational within a discourse of conspiracy theory. And also, because we've got the Bilderberg annual meeting coming up in spring, I'll be speaking to Dr. Ian Richardson more about the Bilderberg group and their elite consensus and what is it the decisions that they're trying to come up with? How is it that these decisions are made? And what are the consequences in terms of global development and globalization in the world without having to use a conspiracy theory as a form of explanation? So if they're interested in conspiracy theory from the social science, it's probably worth checking out that website, and also the Huffington Post. There'll be articles from Ian Richardson and myself and the Bilderberg coming up. And also I'm going to do some podcasts, and that'll be on the YouTube channel, which is Sobrado Social Science. So that's one way to find out more in terms of conspiracy theory and social science.
We'll have all those links on our website, so don't have to feel like you have to rush and write them down, folks. Thank you again for your time, Tony. It's been very pleasant having you here.
Oh, no, great to be here, Don, and wish you the best of other podcasts. I'll be tuning in to see what other kind of skeptical issues you basically investigate and have on a podcast. So thanks for having me on, and speak to you soon.
Okay, we're going to take a bit of a break.
Hello, this is Leo Iwe, Nigerian skeptic, global humanist, and a tireless proponent of rational compassion in the global community. Help promote skepticism and rational thinking by listening to Radio Freethinker. Please subscribe on iTunes. Rational compassion is all about our applying our reason to help humanity, to help enlighten the world.
So, since we are running out of time here on Radio Freethinker, here are my skeptical highlights for the week. And it is none other than the amazing meeting, TAM. This, of course, is the annual conference put on by the James Randi Educational Foundation. This year, of course, is TAM 10, ironically being held in 2012. Nevertheless, TAM 10 looks like it's going to be a great event. Every year, TAM draws in around 1,000 people, sometimes a lot more, to Las Vegas to celebrate skepticism with some of the movement's most engaging speakers, discussing some really important and really serious issues in the skeptical movement. TAM has always been a focal point for the movement of skeptics, free thinkers, and critical thinkers out there. This year, there's an impressive lineup of speakers, and you can learn all about TAM at www.theamazingmeeting.com. Remember, the event takes place from the 12th to the 15th at the South Point Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas. So book your flight, book your hotel, and register for the conference. There, of course, is a early bird registration, so get in on that, and so, you know, pay a little bit less. And remember, it's a great event. If you haven't been to a TAM before, you really owe it to yourself to go to one. I myself am going to TAM, and I hope to interview a lot of great skeptics there. So take a look at the speaker list and let us know, who do you want us to chat with at TAM this year?
Sounds like fun, Ethan. I hope you have a good time. And hey, maybe if I win the lottery, I'll be able to join you as well. So for my skeptic highlight, I've got the Einstein Archive online. I mean, for those scientific nerds out there, this is just to die for. So apparently the Einstein Archives have put all of Albert Einstein's scientific and non-scientific manuscripts online for the first time. So you can see everything he'd ever written. There's a comprehensive database. The site contains over 7,000 high-quality digital images of Einstein's writing. They digitized close to 2,000 of his documents written by Albert Einstein throughout the years. This is quite interesting. And you can find this online by going to alberteinstein.info. Enjoy. I'm sure you'll find something geeky there. I know I did. Another highlight I have to mention is part of the Super Roundup lecture at UBC, Science versus Moral Rhetoric, Sex Work, Politics, and Public Health. According to them, sex work experiences the worst health outcomes globally, with escalating rates of violence, HIV infection, and premature mortality worldwide. Unfortunately, recent history has shown that all too often, moral debates dominate the public health response in sex work, and science continues to take a backstage to punitive approaches aimed at eliminating sex work and, quote, rescue operations. This is despite the ample evidence of the failure of criminalization in preventing harm among sex workers both locally and internationally, and the inadvertent role of these policies and enforcement approaches in exacerbating violence and poor health among sex workers. Growing evidence points to the need for global accountability by policymakers, government, scientists, and international bodies to public health efforts that redress the health inequality gaps among some of the most marginalized individuals. Listen to presenter Dr. Kate Shannon as she discusses this And this is happening downtown in the theater at Robson Square. Lecture starts at 5 p.m. Come on out, learn something.
Well, we're out of time here on Radio Freethinker. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is
a very human form of knowledge. We are always at the brink of the known. Science is a collaborative enterprise spanning the generations. We remember those who prepared the way, seeing through them also.
If you're scientifically literate, the world looks very different to you, and that understanding empowers you.
There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
We can do science, and with it, we can improve our lives.
There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
The story of humans is a story of ideas that shine light into dark corners.
Scientists love mysteries. They love not knowing.
I don't feel frightened by not knowing things. I think it's much more interesting.
There's a larger universal reality of which we are all a part.
The further we probe into the universe, the more remarkable are the discoveries we make.
The quest for the truth in and of itself is a story that's filled with insights.
There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
We can do science, and with it, we can improve our lives.
There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
The story of humans is a story of ideas that shine light into dark corners.
From our lonely point in the cosmos, we have, through the power of thought, been able to peer back to a brief moment after the beginning of the universe.
I think that science changes the way your mind works, to think a little more deeply about things.
Science replaces private prejudice with publicly verifiable evidence. There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
We can do science, and with it, we can improve our lives.